kind of
just stay with that thought. It wasn't as successful in the 80s and 90s. Was it because it was a different territory, or was it because something else had changed? I mean, what?
I have a little bit of opinion that in these other fields, here in water, we were the first one to provide these necessary tests and we were recognized as dedicated to their industry. We were recognized.
We were premier.
We were premier, and we were dedicated to the application of water and wastewater. Everything else we ever tried already had other suppliers, and we were at this point kind of typecast, stereotyped as a supplier of water management systems. Everything else we tried, we were a smaller outside effort, and we were never accepted. I know we were never accepted in food. They said, you know, Hawk is very good in drinking water, but...
Yeah, food analysis.
But food analysis already had other companies who already mm-hmm. provided yeah. that service. So we never had the distinction, their exclusivity.
Well, and you know, but coming on back to the water field, you know, I would use just a slightly different term, perhaps, for Clifford. He was director of innovation. He really wasn't director of R&D, because once you got into research and development, that was a part of the scaling up. You see, Pat that said, to your left last night, mm-hmm. Pat said, well, he said, my lab, and he had people in his lab, said we would get Clifford's ideas, and then we had to scale up. And scaling up, you know, it's hard lots of times, you know. Yeah. So that really became a lot of the R&D got transferred over to these other labs. And so, you know, Cliff had this luxury of just the innovation part, you know, and then the other boys, sometimes they had to do the grunt work, you know, to get it all mm-hmm. up and running.
In the 80s, the move to food and agriculture, what was the driver of that? Had Clifford innovated all he could innovate in the water territory, or what?
Well, you can answer that.
How did that?
He said, well, gosh, if we can do this in water analysis, we can do it in soil analysis. Mm-hmm. Well, boy, it really turned out soil analysis is a whole nother bucket of worms. Mm-hmm. But we really gave soil analysis really quite a try, and actually nobody really does soil analysis well.
But he was the driver of that.
Soil analysis was. Wouldn't you say that Cliff was the driver of going into soil analysis?
I would say so. I always thought it was a little bit of his own agricultural background, and yeah. I think you're right. I think he'd done water for 30 or 40 years, and he'd kind of become a little exhausted with it. And because there were some other things to go to in water. But from here, the next things in water, though, were integrated systems, SCADA systems and automatic, the complicated particle counting and some deeply computerized integrated processes. I don't think that appealed to him quite as much.
No, I didn't.
He was not
computer literate, and he was uncomfortable with that. In transferring from R&D to manufacturing, it was all computerized by this time, and this is when I said the little story last night. He said to me, I can't invent anymore. And that really grieved me, because I could see a hurt in him, but he was honest enough to say this to me, though he probably wouldn't say it to others.
His idea.
And this was said.
Oh, this was not long before he died.
Yeah, his idea of quantitative analysis was manual, even though there's automatic instrumentation, but it was still a human being doing the test and getting test results. Or, well, I do want to touch on this, the process instruments. You really did want to have an operator look at the screen and actually see what the readout was. But integrating computer-driven automated systems didn't appeal to him.
Yeah.
And I think his thought was, and you know, in some respects, he's kind of half right in all this. The drinking water systems is already an integrated flowing system that requires the most minimal amount of human labor to run. Gosh, a drinking water plant could be run by 2 or 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he thought, gosh, why? If that's all it takes, it's...
Why do you have to automate everything?
Yeah, take the test and do the test and walk to a remote site and test at different points and so forth. But and there are other people. You know, the Emerson Electrics of the world. They have these massive SCADA systems that are totally integrated. So if one parameter jumps up a little bit, a valve will shut door. Another reagent will be injected and so forth. And the mega industry didn't appeal to him as much.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's right.
Yes.
In that expression that he made, was another piece of that something to do with the size the company had assumed and the kind of the gap between having an idea and having a product and all the things that had to happen.
Yeah.
Was that a piece of it as well?
I think probably so. Mm-hmm. That though Clifford, as you can see, was a very complex man. And he was very proud and he was very competitive and he wanted the growth. And yet I think that what came with the growth, like what Bruce has described here, really didn't give him the satisfaction mm-hmm. that he would have liked,
mm-hmm.
or that he got from the earlier smaller days when everything was a struggle. And no, really, I used the word earlier that it was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of this gets to be more grudge.
Yes. So, yes. How about your own orientation to those different phases, Kitty? What's your own personal gut?
Well, I would say that in some ways I could share Clifford's feelings, because I realized that though I got more over into the financial end of it, and that was exciting too. So on the other hand, I realized that when I went back to IT, boy. I looked at all those whirling computers, and I had my own little computer, but it was another world back there. And the programming and all that went on. And you realize that, okay, you can't make a contribution to this. This you have to accept what other people tell you. And fortunately, I guess we were more fortunate than what we've been seeing on the TV, because we had people who were honest.
It helps. It helps in the long term.
So, and we didn't ask for anything dishonest.
If I could take you back a little bit.
Please.
It's 1970. Your company is public. You're now sort of something along the line of a mid-sized company. How many employees do you have after you go public? You have building 3 built.
Okay, let's see. Well,
right.
Bruce,
a lot of growth took place just beyond that, from 70. I think in 1970 we're still only about 4, 5, 6 million.
Uh-huh.
Is that
what?
70?
And
after you went public, sort of.
Yeah, well, after you, let's see, we went public in 68 at 1,680,000.
Yeah. So 70, we're only 2 or 3 million.
Yeah, we were 4 or 5 million in there. And
the economy was, I think at that point, fairly good. And
about 400 people, something like that.
The stock was doing well. So those first couple of years were pretty good.
Yeah.
But
is right.
So
go ahead.
Well, I honestly didn't, our stock never, it's a very, very, very stable customer base, and a very, you could almost say parochial, And so our business always remained relatively steady, good, non-cyclical business.
Mm-hmm.
So the stock really never took a wild, bad dive.
No.
And I can't quite remember where.
Well, we did two or three stock splits in order to.
It was a big national recession, 73 and 74.
Yeah, that's right. But we did a number of stock splits in order to try to get more volume out. And that really didn't work. I think at the time that when we went with Danaher, we were in a slump from a stock price standpoint, from the standpoint that small caps were no longer important, and we were a small cap. And we got stagnated at 12.
Mm-hmm. And a PE of about 18, wasn't it?
Of 18 to 20. So we had a pretty good PE, mm-hmm. but we could not budge off of that 12. Mm-hmm. And of course, we had stockholders that were contacting me on a weekly basis about what are you going to do about this stock price. I'm speaking of Will. And
was this individual or institutional?
He was an institution of an individual family,
mm-hmm.
and they had a lot of stock. Mm-hmm. And I never was able to find out how much, but I knew they had a lot. Mm-hmm. He made a pile of money on Hawk,
mm-hmm.
but he wanted that stock price up,
mm-hmm.
and so there was. There was an unpleasant pressure that began to be made.
This is in the late stages.
This would be in the 90s. But he made he called on us once a year. He came to the annual meeting. I'm using him as an example. And he came to all the annual meetings, took a tour of the plant. Man, he followed us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it's probably true.
Then we need to go into Banterra, Don.
From the mid-70s all the way to, there was, the stock was constant. I mean, it wasn't mm-hmm. growing very much. And so the potential, there became maybe a potential disconsolation, because I think a lot of people began to realize, as time went on, that the market we serve is relatively small and a bit of a niche market.
But sales were growing, weren't they?
A single digit. Mm-hmm. I think in the 90s we grew, 80s and 90s, about 7 or 8%, 6 to 9% every year.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah. And there was a lot of people who thought that was just disastrous. Yeah, and this is kind of a sore point for me.
When the boom came, then the bubble of the 90s, you see, we looked like nothing, you know, and yet we were always very profitable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very profitable, high single digits, 7-8%, very stable, actually continuously coming out with better products all the time. Gosh. The final version of this DREL became the DR4000, and we even contract private labeled it for Beckman.
Yeah, we make the Beckman unit today with the Beckman name on it.
Beckman admitted they could not make, they called a low end $5,000 UV vis spectrophotometer better than they could. Mm-hmm. And actually, when things were, but we were constantly under pressure for. Double-digit growth, mm-hmm. like why can't you go up 15% or 20% yes. and so forth.
And, Kitty, this you had to deal with that.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I was, I took a lot of telephone calls.
Mm-hmm. But then, I guess, you know, we keep hearing the word criticism, and it really bothers me. I mean, so it was 8% growth with a PE of 20, and
looks pretty good in 2002.
The company's a major market share leader.
So what's
so horrible about that? But
that's right. We made 15% after
tax. But the dot-com boom in the late 70s was just
that crucified us.
That was kind of a killer.
Yes. Yes. The in there somewhere the before we we've kind of skipped forward. The going overseas.
Okay.
Talk about that, because that's
okay.
a big thing, isn't it?
All right. Well, boy, I tell you, we realized by 1970, you know, we were really feeling pretty foxy here, and we've got to do something about international sales. And so we built a plant in the Namur, Belgium, which is in the Walloon area in the southern part of Belgium. And we opened it in May of 1971. Now that's an... our international sales at that time, I think, well, at that time, I think it was only about 25% of sales. But that...
went up to about 40.
About to 40. So that was a real good move. And then Namur became actually a shipping point. And then we had dealers in all the European countries and Africa. The Saudi Arabia dealer was a big dealer for us. We really did quite well. Got up to about 40%. And of course, the Danaher's shut it down now, but it continued to run. And they had a support staff. They did advertising in foreign languages. We had all the major pieces. There were some things we did in as many as 11 languages.
And you're the person who's in the end got the oversight of all of this. In the end. Isn't that right?
Oh,
I mean, in a sense,
maybe the very. But we did have a director of international sales.
But I mean, who's he report to? Who did he report to?
I've got to think a minute.
Well, I think it was a long time that Jost reported to you.
Yeah.
But then I think there were other times that they actually just reported to the highest VP of
sales and marketing.
Who reported to?
Who reported to Kitty?
Kitty.
Yeah, okay. I mean, let's. I'm just in the 70s and 80s. I mean, here's in the structure of the company. There's you and Clifford at the top.
Okay, it reported to us.
Not too many people are reporting to Clifford, are they?
No,
not at this point.
Right.
No,
he was tripling.
Though Jost Everett was certainly the manager of that plant. Felt very close to Clifford, and
he kind of idolized him.
He did, and they were good friends. Yeah. And it came into my office.
Yeah. And, if essentially, would this be true that from going public through to 98 and the sale, the company is.
99.
The company is large enough and complex enough that in operating reality, it needs a CEO and de facto you are that person.
That would be right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. But obviously you can't do it all, and so there were others that were very much involved. We had Paul Goltz who did
South America,
and we had a fellow who did the Far East, so that became another little group, and they had their own reporting. So sure, they were monitored very carefully. Yes. But
You've got this. I mean, I'm now thinking of CEOs of technology companies in the United States. Number one, I don't know too many CEOs who were CEO for 30 years. I certainly I think you're the only woman in that category to my knowledge of technology
companies. Well, it's true there weren't many. Yeah.
So talk if you would through that 30-year span when the economy changed in varieties of ways as well as Hark changing. Talk about what it's like to have
well, gone through
okay, that life.
Well, all right. I would say that there were a lot of changes, and putting together organizational charts did become a lot more important. What I would really like to maybe say that I think that we were very good in the budgeting area. And it was through budgeting that there were sales to be met and there were earnings to be made. And we had good accounting. And therefore, the department heads knew where they stood in all of these areas.
So there's essentially good discipline.
Yeah, I would say that there was good discipline. I don't really know how to address we had the budgets, we knew what we were looking for, we knew what the and we followed them. Do you want to know how often did we meet?
Tell me all aspects of how just talk about how you managed the company, if it were.
We had boardroom, and there were meetings in there all of the time, and of course the senior officers met regularly. Often we ate together. So it wasn't as formal, perhaps, as what you are mm-hmm. searching mm-hmm. for. It was more informal, but I would like to say we had excellent communication. People knew what was going on. There were no secrets at Hawk. Mm-hmm. And we used to say, that was a little expression, there's no point in having a secret around here, because it's going to get out. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you have good communication, you know what's going on. And we had that.
Mm-hmm. But the decision to go overseas, I mean, how did that come to pass?
To go overseas. Well, we had a young man by the name of Klaus Weidner, who was we'd gotten out of. He was a German, had come up out of one of our dealers in South America, and he came here, and he was starting to develop more and more sales, and we realized, if we're really going to be able to serve those dealers, this was an analysis. If you're going to really serve the dealers, you've got to have inventory closer to them. This thing of trying to ship by air or by, which was very expensive, or by container, which was very cheap but very slow, you've got to get it over to where there is a distribution. So there was really quite a analysis was made, and we said, okay, let's do it. And we figured out then what size building we needed, and we put up the money for it and built it and put the inventory in there. And then there was one of the men from the Ames plant by the name of Dan Gerber, who was a senior vice president of chemistry. And Dan went over and ran that plant.
Now, the marketing in Europe might have been a little different. I mean, you weren't sending letters to every municipal water company at this point.
No, we found. Oh no, we tried. You know, we tried some direct mail and found out that didn't work in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sure that we could make it work, and I was completely wrong.
Europe is had
is different.
They had a little bit more of a. I don't even call it even more old fashioned, a little more of an antiquated direct sales concept. They actually had people who would become manufacturers reps of a specific discipline. So there were people who were manufacturers reps in the area of drinking water and wastewater,
mm-hmm.
and they were actually pretty good. They're often engineers, and they really understood exactly how the operation worked, and they really knew all the local country's regulations. And they would also sell other things. They'd sell hardware and pipes and filter beds and so forth, but they would sometimes take on the Hawk account and then represent the virtues of our product in their system. And of course, what they wanted was exclusivity for an entire country. And but they were essentially engineers advocating where Hawk fit into the system. And America didn't really have anything quite like that. But in Europe, that was the way you do business.
Mm-hmm.
But there was positive sides too. They So they just simply bought our products at about a 20 or 30% discount, maybe 40%. Then the negative was they resold it at a very high price. But it provided a low barrier of entry to get into those.
That's right.
To get into those markets. And so then we inventoried a lot of items in Europe and they could buy them directly and so forth.
What about the move to Loveland? What?
Before we go there, yes. Early 1970s. 1970 is when the EPA is created under Nixon. Mm-hmm. I believe the Clean Water Act dates to 74. I have to look up the exact date. What kind of impact does that have on your business in terms of, I mean, it creates more market. There's more demand for equipment to monitor and oversee water, but there's also more standardization required, right? You have to be EPA certified then suddenly. What does this do for you in both the research and marketing and other areas?
It's mixed. It's very mixed.
That's exactly right.
You want me to go first on that one?
Okay, you go.
Yeah, deeply mixed. But we already had a whole lot of tests already in the system that once the EPA was authorized, they actually liked a lot. Mm-hmm. They liked our chlorine systems. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of early, we did take kind of advantage, the positive side, a lot of early certification. So we got this turbidimeter approved, and portable turbidimeter. Chlorine systems, COD systems, I think about like 22 parameters got a quick approval, and they really liked it. But from that point on, the EPA was really uncertain as to exactly how far to go with certification and what certification should be and the potential competitive impacts or ramifications of certification. And so certification after that became much, much, much slower. Mm-hmm. And its policy gyrated back and forth. And so it became a question for us, how much effort and money do we put in a certification attempt? Basically, I think we decided what we really were providing was inherent, necessary, intrinsic tests at a different point in water management. And we kind of backed away from putting too much effort into certification. We took what we got, but we basically just simply tried to provide the tests that were needed. And we didn't start chasing EPA certification for the sake of business or exclusivity. And it turned out that was actually, whether we were right or wrong, it turned out to be working. I think we worked out just
quite well. That's right. And as the EPA grew, it became more bureaucratic, much more difficult to get anybody to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, it, boy, working with the EPA is frustrating because I think probably this is true of any government organization, but the EPA is certainly a classic example.
But you couldn't run a business on EPA certification and expect to get certified and then exclusive rights and then try to keep non-certified people out. So I think in some respects we kind of got the best of both worlds. We did get certification, but we stayed away from letting them dictate our strategy or letting them dictate a direction.
We were back in being independent again. And of course a lot of customers said, customers would say, okay, we're going to run the EPA classic method for the reporting purposes, but to run the plant, we're going to run it with Hawk.
Yeah.
Okay. There
were some tests that required standard methods for reporting purposes, but that might only have to be done like once a month. Mm-hmm. Or even
once a quarter. Not too bad.
I don't think our customers changed their habits significant. So what it wasn't, mm-hmm. and it is true, the EPA really isn't quite, never was, and never is quite sure exactly what's the best way to administer water regulations. We tried not to be certainly obstinate or impolite, and we actually did serve on some committees
And we took advantage of any committee we were invited to join, we did. But we decided essentially that EPA certification was not the
the end goal
not
for
the
us.
Determinant of our business.
Okay.